I just wanted, while we're still on the advisory bodies, to ask you to assess their performance, their strengths and weaknesses, because they, each organization is a different kind of organization.
Very different.
And functions differently.
Yeah. Well, let's deal with ICRON first, which is a kind of relatively easy one. I always found them extremely constructive and helpful, very focused on what they could do, not trying to do things that they couldn't do. They were good both in the relation to the the training work that the committee wanted developed, and specifically within the operational guidelines. And the individuals there, I thought, were very good. I mean, Herb and others, so Kitrin, and so, you know, I thought there was a good organisation. I found ICOMOS more problematic, I think part of ICOMOS's problem is that World Heritage is almost their raison d'etre. So there's a huge expectation laid on them and internally within them to perform, and they're faced with in some ways a much more complex and difficult job than IUCN has, because of the culturally related nature of assessment of culture, which doesn't really arise in the scientific field and in the IUCN field to the same extent, in the sense that, you know, an Indian biologist will have the same view about something as a North American one or a Fiji one. Whereas I think that you have real difficulties in within ICOMOS in having that degree of understanding the many, many different cultural positions that people might come to in looking at whether something is of outstanding universal value. As you know, I mean, some cultural landscapes have very high natural values. Þingvellir in Iceland is the sort of one of several which I went and looked at, where, you know, there is this important cultural bit. That's the origin of the Icelandic nation and so forth. But you've also got this incredible place where the earth is splitting open. You've got the Atlantic divide between the two tectonic plates open. You can see it with your eyes. You can even feel it because it sort of shakes practically every day a little bit. It's the most dramatic place in telling an earth science story as well as a cultural story. But the convention says, for reasons that if you go back into the Santa Fe discussions in 1992, you can understand why cultural landscapes are regarded as on the cultural side.
My memory of the beginning of the cultural landscapes universe is that IUCN didn't really step up to the plate and didn't really want to be involved in it. Is that correct? And that sort of ICOMOS ended up taking over the assessment, really, of cultural landscapes by default, in a sense.
I'm not sure it's completely true. Certainly, the dear late Bing Lucas was a very strong advocate for it, and he was at that stage had the position. Was he at that stage the chairman of the WCPA? But he was also, I think so, because he was my.
Yes, I think so too.
That. And he was also much involved in the drafting of the definition of cultural landscapes, the identification of those three categories, you know, associative and designed.
Mm-hmm. Right, the two meetings.
But that's right. I think one was at Santa Fe, wasn't it? One was at
Santa Fe is where it was presented to the committee, one was at La Petite Pierre.
Petite Pierre, sorry, that's it. And he was very much in that. And by all accounts, he was one of the people who took a lead in that. So to that extent, I think IUCN, through Bing's involvement, was very actively involved. However, my understanding was that it partly went back to what in the roots of the convention itself, where best this could sit. And because of the wording under the cultural bit of the pillar of the convention, it fitted more happily under that. Under sites, mm-hmm. yes, than it did under the natural properties. And that that meant it had to be led by ICOMOS. And there are lots of cultural landscapes where ICOMOS, you know, would just get a letter from IUCN quite rightly saying we have no interest, or there is no natural interest here of any great importance. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few where there's a considerable amount, and there are some where you could well argue the natural things are as important, or if not more important. It's a rather foolish way of looking at it, but you couldn't possibly look at it without taking into account the huge natural site significance.
Right. It's still an area that I think challenges the committee.
Yeah, I think it challenges the bodies too. But there's also a good deal more to be said about IUCN than just obviously about cultural landscapes. I mentioned that for ICOMOS, World Heritage was the raison d'etre, is the raison d'etre, it's right at the centre. And if World Heritage Committee collapsed tomorrow, I think ICOMOS would pretty well collapse, or would be rather pointless little organisation. That's not true of IUCN. If the World Heritage Committee were wrapped up tomorrow, there'd be a few tears, but IUCN would roll on. And it, you know, I don't know, it's sort of 2% of its activities or something. It's quite small. The difficulty in IUCN was to try and get people, other than the team who had direct involved in it, to appreciate the significance and the potential that lay in the convention to achieve IUCN's wider purposes. And that's considerable, because you can use World Heritage Sites as standard setters. You can use them to focus on issues of much wider significance, mining in protected areas. The whole debate about mining in protected areas, which really set IUCN alight, started with the kind of problems we had in Huascarán, well, and Kakadu, and half a dozen other properties, World Heritage properties, and it spread out to be a debate about mining in protected areas as a whole.